Previously on the Film Stage Show.
And now for the second part of our program.
Yeah, who's still got the energy to talk about Patterson? Like, can we? Can I call an audible and say that should we should just record Patterson like midweek?
We can do that.
Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema for your free 30-day trial of Mubi. All you have to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Bus stop, wet day, she's there, I say it, please share my umbrella. Bus stop, bus go, she stays, love grows under my umbrella.
Ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast from filmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, in part two of our epic two-part series, we have Michael Snydell.
I'm back!
And Bill Graham. We are here today to deliver on what we promised in the last episode, and that is a review of the movie Patterson, the newest film from writer-director Jim Jarmusch. This film stars Adam Driver as a bus driver. This is going to... Oh, I'm already going to tell that I have trouble here. Adam Driver plays a bus driver named Patterson who drives a bus in Patterson, New Jersey. And, yeah... We'll just leave it at that for now. In the meantime, you can also follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show, Facebook, The Film Stage Show. Email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. And yeah, that's about that. I'm gonna give you all one more week where I don't give you some shit about not giving us comments and ratings on iTunes. But when I get back from my vacation, goddammit, be prepared. Because I'm going to lay into ya. Anyway, gentlemen, how y'all doing? Have you suitably recovered from us having to talk about Boo, a Madea Halloween?
No, it's probably beyond repair at this point, but that's okay.
This show will never be the same.
Before and after Boo.
I'm just trying to think of like TV shows that have had like a defining episode where like nothing will be the same. Like maybe in Homicide.
Before and after The Constant.
Yeah, in Lost, before and after The Constant. The Leftovers, before and after International Assassin. And that episode of Homicide where Detective Pemberton has a stroke. For all my Homicide heads out there.
Sure.
Yeah. You've never seen Homicide, have you?
No, I know
about it. Before and after The Red Wedding.
No, that's a good one, Bill. I would almost say before and after Baylor, too.
Yeah, Baylor. Baylor's a good one.
Yep. I would say Game of Thrones has like one of those episodes every season.
Wait, is this the name Baylor?
A little bit. A little bit.
Wait. No, Baylor. Baylor is the Baylor of the Sept.
No, all right. This is too much. We told Jordan we weren't going to do this.
This is true. Before I do the movie plug, we have heard you, ladies and gentlemen. We know you want us to talk about television, and we swear to God we're going to try soon. We keep meaning to, but I don't even know why it's not happening, in all honesty. But
it's because of me?
It's not even because of you, because we've had at least two...
Yes, you have.
Work at the film stage, say like, I would love to talk TV with you, and we're like, great. And then we just like are lazy and we don't do it, but we will. But this is good because now the next time we speak, the series finale of The Leftovers will have happened, so I will be able to hijack the conversation anytime that I can in order to talk about The Leftovers, which, as we all know, is like the highlight of my living life. Anyway, all movie. Right.
it's riding high pretty well right now, right?
Oh,
you're what, two episodes out?
I think there's only one left. I think it's happening this Sunday. Anyway.
It's happening, Brian.
It's happening.
This is probably a good plug for, as well, for the other podcast on the Film Stage.
Oh yeah. the Dark Mood Woods, Dark Woods Mood.
I'm so glad we know the name.
I helped them. I have like an executive producer credit on it because I had to help them learn how to podcast. It is about Twin Peaks, the revival of Twin Peaks, which is out. I've seen the first four episodes. It's just as weird as you'd expect. And if you want to hear Nick Newman, formerly of this show, talk about it, I mean, like, I don't know why we're talking about this, but like, I love that recap culture is a thing now, because I'm having the most fun watching all these people who like do a new podcast for every single possible thing that is happening, having to struggle to do recap podcasts of Twin Peaks. Because it's not like, ooh, Westworld, like, what new things did we learn? Like, who's a replicant and who's not? And, like, who is the Black Rider? And then they go and, like, they do Twin Peaks, and it's like, so what'd you think about that tree with a face on it? And it's just, like, what do you think that means? It's like, it's David Lynch. It could mean literally nothing, or it could be everything. So
you're saying the podcast is 30 seconds every week?
I mean, they still stretch it out. They like these, you know, and then like the writers who are like, let's talk about the clues that we found on the new episode of Twin Peaks: The Return. And it's like, yeah, what clues? Like, you don't know what a clue is. This is David Lynch. Like, this isn't Christopher Nolan's brother, Jonathan, who's like, you know, laying out things very carefully in a Nolan-esque kind of way. This is David Lynch, who literally will be like, you know, it would be awesome right here. Just like a rabbit with a top hat. Fucking holding a gun. And
now I want to start.
I really need to catch up on Twin Peaks. Jeez.
There has never been a rabbit with a top hat holding a gun.
Damn it.
Me making it up. However, you can go on YouTube and find David Lynch's short film Rabbits, which is a series of rabbits dressed like humans, or humans with giant paper mache rabbit heads having indecipherable conversations.
And it's a part of Inland Empire as well,
yes,
isn't it?
It was sampled in Inland Empire.
Okay.
Yes. Anyway, we are brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. Mubi has curators who find some great films for you to watch. You can download these things to your mobile device so that you can watch on the go. As I say, every time I'm going on vacation, it's going to be sweet because I'm going to have Mubi with me. I'm going to download a bunch of films. Gonna watch them on my phone because I just realized I don't even know if the beach house we're going to has a DVD player. So I am scared, but I am not too scared because Mubi is there for me. So if you would like a free 30-day trial of Mubi, all you gotta do is go to mubi.com/filmstage and you will get your free 30-day trial of Mubi on us. There is a Philip Gorel Philippe Gorel retrospective going on. And we have coming The Virgin's Bed, which sounds, I mean, first of all, Mubi is great at like laying you in with a hook on the log line. It's called A Cinematic Conflagration and Reinvention of Biblical Storytelling for a Culture and an Audience Having Just Passed Through the Convulsions of May 1968. I don't need to know anymore.
What?
The convulsions. Okay. Yeah. All right.
What happened in 1968?
Was
that Vietnam?
That was wasn't
was that the assassination?
I'm trying to answer. Wait, which is okay. First of all, someone was probably assassinated, but it wasn't JFK or Martin Luther King Jr. If that's what you're thinking, I think that's when Something in the Air was positioned.
Ah,
What?
Something in the Air. Did you not see Something in the Air, Bill?
No.
Oh.
No.
Just kind of a time of unrest and cultural shifting then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Anyway, mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. So now we're going to talk about Patterson. This, again, is the new film by writer-director Jim Jarmusch. And it is about a young man who is a poet who is also a bus driver, played by Adam Driver, in the city of Patterson, whose name is Patterson. And it's basically a week in his life and dealing with him and his live-in girlfriend and her dog. And the assorted cast of characters who revolve in and out of his life in all of his comings and goings. So that is Patterson. It's what we're going to talk about now. And here is the trailer.
Morning, Donnie. Everything okay?
No, not really. My kid needs braces on her teeth. My car needs a transmission job. My wife wants me to take her to Florida, but I'm behind on the mortgage payments. My uncle called from India and he needs money for my niece's wedding, and I got this strange rash on my back. How about you?
I'm okay.
Ready to roll, Patterson?
Yeah. When you're a child, you learn there are three dimensions: height, width, and depth. Like a shoe.
All right. So that is the trailer for Patterson. This movie came out last year. We were going to talk about it, and then we didn't talk about it, and then we were going to talk about it again, and then we didn't talk about it again. But here we are, finally talking about it, talking about Patterson. Let's see if it has been worth the wait and the machinations that have taken us to this point. And again, we were supposed to talk about it on the last episode, but who knew we would spend an hour and 20 minutes talking about Boo, a Madea Halloween. Anyway, Michael Snydell, Patterson, Jim Jarmusch.
Oh.
What are your thoughts?
Okay, you're starting with me. All right.
I'm so sorry. Bill Graham. No. Patterson.
Sure.
Jim Jarmusch. What are your thoughts?
Let's go. you want me to go? I'll go. I got this.
If you're not ready, you know, I'm going to pass the ball to the guy who's open.
I'm ready. I'm so flattered by the...
Nope. You're not ready. I'm going.
No, I am. I have my notes.
I've hijacked.
All right. Bill, go ahead. Go ahead. You finished your food now, I guess. Go ahead.
Yeah. Nope, the food's sitting over to the side. I'm just ready. okay, so... I do believe this is the first Jarmusch film that I've seen. Booze, yeah... Oohs and ahs, yeah. Go ahead.
Whatever. No one said anything.
Is just bad podcasting. I silently began shaking my head while staring into my own lap, and then I was
see?
Like, "Oh wait,
exactly." Yeah. So there it is. Perfect. So this is my introduction to him, and from what I understand, he is a very kind of ponderous kind of adventurous sort. He likes to kind of delve into a subject and really kind of get into kind of the nitty gritty of it. He likes to focus on kind of the minutia of life and things like that. And so this film is very much in line with that. What I was going in kind of expecting, what I had heard about some of his films and things like that. And so one thing that I was pleasantly surprised by is how much I actually enjoyed myself. This movie is nearly 2 hours long. Yes, I will forever mention how long a film is. It just won't go unnoticed. But that being said, I really enjoyed a lot of this film and the rhythms that it kind of finds itself in. I'm not a big poetry reader, and yet this film really, the poetry in it doesn't necessarily have to rhyme, and it's so like there are people that can argue back and forth about like poetry and how it should rhyme and how it shouldn't rhyme and all this bullshit. Honestly, if it's written well, it reads well. And Adam Driver's voice, like, there's a lot of people that really like his voice. I'm happen to be one of those as well. I love hearing him talk. And so, you know, there's the common refrain about, you know, you could give someone a phone book and, you know, it would be a pleasure to just hear them read off the names, right? Adam Driver just happens to have one of those really nice, kind of enjoyable voices. Jeff Bridges is up there for me, is one of those as well. But so I'm not a big poetry fan. This film still found a rhythm. It still found a way to kind of entertain me and still kind of keep me going. I love some of the subtle bits of humor that are planted in this that if you blink, you'll kind of miss. It's very dry humor. I absolutely adore the dog in this film and his interaction towards the end of the film, which you kind of realize about him. I love that he plays a central role. And I love that there's just kind of this internal struggle with this guy that is obviously very talented, but doesn't necessarily know how to bring that out into the world. And his girlfriend is just a complete and utter trip. Every time she's on screen, she's kind of a delight. This film is just really, in a lot of ways, it's very lighthearted, and in a lot of ways, it's kind of ponderous, and it has a lot on its mind. And I just found it really an enjoyable, like, waste of 2 hours. Like, it really was. It was very enjoyable. And I can see a lot of people just being like, this was terrible, this was awful, nothing happens in this movie. And, you know, it's not going to be for everybody. So that's my thoughts.
All right. Michael Snydell.
I am familiar with Jarmusch's stuff more than Bill. I've probably seen about 4 or 5 of his films. Like, if I was going to characterize his kind of 2000s output, I'd say for his whole career, he kind of has like this off-kilter humanism, in the sense that he finds these characters that are, you know, have odd experiences with their environments, and, you know, in things like Stranger Than Paradise, or are literally it's impossible for them to not be outsiders, and things like Only Lovers Left Alive. And so Patterson, like, is really interesting in the sense that it is, as Bill says, it offers so many ins into its story, which I like and also don't at the same time, because I think the movie is it has this really a nice digressive style as it just kind of goes in and out of Patterson, Adam Driver's character's days, and the ways that he just has these little observations in his routine, whether it be, you know, passengers who are having a discussion about how they are both unable to ask a girl out, or just how he becomes a regular at a bar, where it's not like you get the sense that he is someone who draws attention to himself at the bar. He's not like a comedian or anything, but he's someone who just is such a regular presence in so many places in the city of Patterson, that he just kind of becomes this institution. And that's a really interesting idea. I do think the movie does have this, does mostly find this balance of neatness to the way that everything kind of goes. Like, going along with, for like a small example that's not spoilery, like, there is an early discussion about how Patterson's girlfriend, played by Asghar Farhadi, I'm going to mess up the name, Goldshiftith Farahani, I believe is her name. And she keeps having this recurring dream about twins. And then just like throughout the rest of the movie, that's like this recurring visual motif that, yeah, that plays kind of different roles. And it never has, like, you know, grand consequence or anything, but it kind of goes with the very like elliptical style of the movie. I guess what I'd say specifically, if I was going to like define it, I think almost everything on the bus is perfect. I have more complicated feelings about the domestic stuff, but I guess the one other last thing I want to say is I find it really refreshing that this is a portrait of creativity that's not about it as this vice, as this, you know, demon that's constantly scratching at your back. Because you see a lot of movies about creativity, you know, being something that, you know, causes an existential spiral, or needs to be coming from, you know, some great demon or something. And that's not to say those aren't also great portraits of creativity, because I think we can all speak for how much writing sucks sometimes. But there is something really unique and satisfying about how writing here is seen as this pursuit that you can only go to at certain points, but when you get in the kind of in the zone for it, it becomes this sublime thing, this thing that your entire world revolves around. And it doesn't necessarily bother you, and it doesn't become your whole life, but it's a feeling that you strive for constantly. And so in that way, I think the movie's a really interesting character portrait. It's just a little bit I just wish it was it was willing to just kind of leave a little more mystery about this life and about the poetry. It's not that it's necessarily pat, but it certainly has an idea that it takes to the end. But I can't see this as a Jarmusch movie that I want to, like, you know, constantly repeat. And that might just be a personal preference, that I just like how idiosyncratic something like Only Lovers Left Alive is more than this. But I think it's also that I think it, you know, I saw this all the way back in September and I just rewatched it, but it was still something that, you know, it's pleasant and it has a fantastic lead performance, but it kind of dissipates out of your mind, which, you know, doesn't make it a bad movie, but doesn't make it a totally memorable movie.
Yeah, I would say this movie is almost aggressively unmemorable. I'm sensing a theme to all of our opinions here. And I don't know, it's like Adam Driver's fine in it. There's a lot of details that, like, I'm not sure what to make of at first. I guess in general I'll say I was, like, fine with this movie, but it's definitely the least of all of the Jarmusch movies that I've seen recently. Like, you know, I've seen Broken Flowers, I've seen The Limits of Control, I've seen Only Lovers Left Alive, and I like all of those considerably more than I liked Patterson. And
do you think that has to do with that neatness? Just to pause you right there, I'm just curious.
The neatness in this story?
Yes.
Yeah, I honestly think it is one of those things. Like, it's just, you know, like, they keep bringing up, like, famous people who lived in Patterson, and, like, you know, there's all these kind of loving shots of, like, this rundown town, and you can, like, you can feel what the movie's doing, but I don't feel as though it's doing it particularly well or interestingly. Like, it's honestly, like, didn't even really feel like a Jarmusch movie to me, because, like, the weirdness wasn't there that I'm used to. Like, I'm one of the few people who, like, unabashedly loved The Limits of Control, and, like, but I could never defend that movie. Like, it's mm-hmm. very easy for me to see how someone could hate that movie. Only Lovers Left Alive was fine. I feel like I was more interested in the ideas at the outskirts of the story rather than, like, what the story was actually doing. And this just was, like, it was so low-key and, like, so pointless. Like, it doesn't feel like a necessary or vital work. It just kind of exists and then evaporates once it's over. And, like, there are things that I was reading into it that I'm not sure if they were meant to, but, like, maybe they are, because, like, there's this whole thing where he's writing these poems in this one book and he never shows them to anyone, and his girlfriend seems like this utter dilettante who, like, you know, is making cupcakes and painting everything black and white, and then she orders a guitar from Esteban. Have any of you guys seen, like, the Esteban, like, Home Shopping Network or infomercials?
I had one.
You had one?
Yeah, I've heard of him. Yeah, nice.
Oh my God. When I was first starting guitar, yeah.
I have to ask you, did you see the commercial and then you're like, Mom, Dad, please get me this guitar?
No, I got it for a gift. I'd been playing guitar for a little bit and I didn't have an acoustic. I had an electric. Uh-huh. And my dad saw it and thought it would be a good gift. I don't know where he saw it, but I have seen those infomercials after. And I had those DVDs, so I got a sense of what it was like, or you know, what the presentation was like, and it's pretty absurd.
Yeah, I mean, if you've never seen Esteban, he's like this guy. He like wears like all black and sunglasses and one of these like a ridiculous like flat top, flat brim hat, and he like has this like really deep gravelly voice and like. They make
he looks like Zorro.
Yeah, he's like an older, heavyset Zorro, and like he just has like this air about him. Like they really pushed him as like this guitar virtuoso who like studied under a master, and he's just like the biggest marketing gimmick on earth. And like
he happily sold out.
Beautiful this guitar is, and like oh, it's like a rosewood handle, and it's got all this, and it's like a solid wood construction, and it's like. It's the cheapest, shittiest guitar, apparently, that you can ever have. And I spent upwards of 30 minutes on YouTube trying to find... Because when I was a kid, I was a paperboy. Mm-hmm. And Saturdays and Sundays was morning delivery. So I had to get up at, like, 5 in the morning, get the papers, and then I would sit in my living room and fold them. And at that time, children, we didn't have, like, 24-hour, like, great television... channels going on, so I would watch infomercials as I was doing this. So I'm well versed in the Showtime rotisserie oven, the Red Devil you know, portable grilling system, banjo minnows, the fishing lures, and I was deeply versed in Esteban and his guitar. So like he's talking about buying this guitar and I'm like, oh okay, this is like someone buying like a Cutco knife or something, and like it's just like the most ridiculous thing you could do to believe that you're going to buy this guitar and see these DVDs and like you're going to become a country star. But then like at a certain point it seems to shift and be like the mere fact that she is like putting herself out there and like willing to show off what she's doing means that inherently she's better than Patterson. But I don't know that the movie, like, I don't know if that's text or something I'm reading into it.
Can you go a little bit more what you mean?
Well, because
that it's better.
It's just like, you know, she has this guitar, and as far as we know, she's never played guitar before. She has this guitar for like 3 hours before he gets home, and she can already play what was it? Someone I've been working on the railroad.
Sure.
And that's crazy. Like that's a big jump for someone who's just started, and then. Not only that, but like she's talking about how she has to make these cupcakes for the farmer's market, and we've seen that like some of the food she makes isn't great, but then like she goes to the farmer's market and sells them and makes like a bunch of money. And it's just, it's like they set her up as this kind of like sub manic pixie dream girl, because she just kind of stays home and seems to be puttering around, and she talks about how like, oh, you know, maybe I can open up my own cupcake shop, or I have this lifelong dream of being a country star, or I'm just gonna like, you know, keep painting black and white stuff. But like, the crazy thing is that at some point, she like is really good at all of these things.
Yeah, she seems to pick things up pretty quick. One thing that kind of percolates throughout the film is kind of, for me at least, was this initial fear that she was completely and utterly made up, that she was just in his imagination, because she never leaves the house. You never see her leave the house. She's always talking about leaving the house, but you never see her leave at all, ever. And it's not until about, I guess, an hour into the film when you actually see her get in the car and start to drive off, and you're like, holy shit, she's real. So, yeah, because I mean, there's this black and white motif that's going on, and she's always home when he's home, and she's always like, yeah, I was doing this and I was gonna leave, but you know, I got tied up with this, and she has all these excuses for why she didn't leave, or you know, she's never coming back. We never see her outside of the house for such a long time in this film that it was really like, please don't let her be in imagination. Like this would just be such a weird movie if that was true.
That is,
but yeah,
I never even thought about that. That would have been real fucked up.
Yeah,
I think that's what this is going to be really weird. And I know it's you guys probably can, you know, refute this, but I think that's what almost makes this, you know, you're saying that this is aggressively pleasant, Brian, but I do think that there is something admirable in how stubbornly wholesome it is and how much it wants to be idealistic about these characters and like even be extremely earnest with, you know, even when you think about some of the choices that they use when Patterson is writing his poetry is they do superimpositions of this lake while the poetry text is literally showing up on screen in slow motion as he's reciting it. Like there is as much as you can say that like there isn't that much that happens here or it's not a particularly like it doesn't have a lot of push to it. There is a very distinctive style here that other directors wouldn't do that I can see Jarmusch doing. It's in other things as well in terms of how he uses fade to blacks and how he uses them very much in a way that draws your attention. And he uses them not only to like signify the end of a day, but to signify the end of almost like these episodes. And that kind of goes back into a little bit what that kind of piggybacks of what Bill is saying is that like, you know, when we cut to her at home, it is almost cut and edited in a way that, you know, it's this hazy mirage that he's almost imagining of her, you know, painting the curtains, her, you know, whatever flight of fancy she's doing that day. There is like this like constant respect for these characters in their mundane lives without like any of the psychological damages that seem to come in a character study like this.
Yeah.
Like there is something very, it's sad that that's unique these days, but when you see character studies, it's like there always has to be that baggage that they're bringing in. And I'm not saying that's bad, but I'm just saying that it's so funny that Bill actually had to wonder whether she was real even that far into the movie because he's been conditioned that someone like this character must have a screw loose.
Well, I had like a similar thing, you know, I like there's a picture of Patterson in like a Marine Corps dressing room.
First shot of the movie, I believe.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh, okay, he used to be a Marine. And like that never really comes up. Like he never like says anything about it.
In the bar, potentially.
Yeah, and like but then like there were so many twin imagery that I was like, oh my god, what if it was his brother who was in the Marines and his brother is dead or something? And like I was doing that same thing because I was just like, there's no way that the movie is about this little, right? Like
Yeah.
It's
like, not a De Palma movie.
I must be missing something. And like, you know, there's a point where a guy pulls a gun and then it turns out that it's an airsoft gun. And like, you know, the bus breaks down and every single person says the same thing. Like, it could have exploded into a fireball.
It's a great it's like, line.
All these people like just kind of trying to put more onto something than there is. And it's like, I'm doing the same fucking thing to this movie. Cause it's like, what if his twin is dead? What if his girlfriend isn't real? And then I was like, what if there's a problem with her? Because she just seems to be like stuck in this house, like painting things. And he's like not a fan of her cooking sometimes. And he just kind of like observes her painting her own dresses while they're on her or like doing stuff to the curtains. And I'm like, is he going to murder her? Or like, did he find her somewhere? Like, are they even a couple? Like, what is happening right now?
Yeah. Is she because just locked inside?
There's so little, like, even, like, not even passion, but, like, romance between them. Like, they're just these, and there's that fucking dog. And, like, it's so weird because they set up this concept of, like, the dog is going to get stolen or something is going to happen to the dog.
Sure.
But then nothing happens to the dog. And it's like, I can kind of understand. This is a little bit like a faster paced but less important John Dielman. if any of you have seen.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Chantal Ackerman, right?
Yeah.
Did we just like spoil the shit out of this movie, or did we just kind of like?
No,
yeah.
I think that there's one thing that counts as a spoiler,
we haven't mentioned it, so I think we're fine.
Sure.
And, like, we can jump into spoilers at some point if you want, but like, there's a crazy thing about this is that like, I don't feel as though learning anything about this movie will detract from the impact of watching the movie, because so much of it is just
I don't think so either
in performance and seeing it and like the rhythms of the movie playing.
It's just a meditative experience that. Yeah, you need to see.
Here is another question that I would like to pose to you. Is Patterson a good poet? And does it matter if he's good or not?
I would say about half the time. I mean, I think the one scene that's really interesting is when he meets that little girl, mm-hmm. and her poetry mm-hmm. is perhaps better than anything he writes in the film. You know, that's arguable, but like... Personally, I thought her poem was more interesting than almost anything he wrote. And I do think there is a question, too, about whether he cares whether his poetry is good. Because, you know, while I'm sorry, I really should have Farhani's. Okay, Laura. Like, Laura is the one who is constantly pushing him, you know, to save his
publisher
to publish it or to put it out in there in the world, and
he says at some point just photocopy it so you have an extra
sure copy. But like and she being someone who is so like creatively driven, even if she's so restless, like it seems like she just wants the same thing for him and recognizes that makes him happy. But I'm not sure that Patterson's character is ever sure that his or cares that his poetry is good or bad. I think he recognizes that it's just something that he finds some process through. It's some small catharsis in his life. And even when, you know, like, I'm edging very close to something else to finish my point, but I'm not going to mention that. Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there's it's ambiguous, and I think could be read either way.
I mean, it's almost a movie about how art doesn't have to be on display for it to be meaningful. Like, you know, this guy, it's not even fair to say that like it has no place in its life, because literally we see him composing these things throughout his day, and it's something that he gets something out of. So it's like. This weird thing where, unlike, you know, most art-driven films where it's like, you gotta get a publisher and, like, maybe I'm not good enough, he's just like, it doesn't matter if anyone ever sees it, just because he is getting what he needs to out of the process of doing it, and that's what's important. And that's, you have to have that baseline if you're ever going to become great at something.
Sure.
And this movie kind of is one of the few that says, and maybe that baseline is all that you need to be happy in your life. Like, maybe that's the one thing you need to feel like you're more than a drone, is this outlet. And even if no one ever watches it or looks at it or reads it, you know, you're feeling good. You're feeling fine because you know you can if you want to. And it's a way to bring about a little extra piece of yourself into the world.
I honestly wish more filmmakers were willing to do that. I'm sorry, Bill. I interrupted you there.
You're right. One thing I want to mention is the fact that he is constantly like stopping and starting his poems, and he's also rewriting them on the fly. And I really enjoy kind of seeing that process and him kind of refine his technique on the fly during the film itself. I'm not sure if I can't quite remember if he ever like actually revisits a different poem while he's working on one. I think he pretty much finishes each one individually, but he's definitely like, you know, while he's getting started in the morning, he's always like scribbling down furiously right before he starts his shift. And, you know, he's backtracking and he's going over his lines and then pushing forward and then, you know, making a kind of discovery. He's stuck at certain points. And so I really enjoyed kind of following that journey of someone creating something, but it's not a perfect one off, like, oh, he just wrote it. right from scratch from the get-go and it's finished. No, a lot of times he's stopping, starting, rewriting, reworking, and then moving forward. And I think it's good to show that kind of process, because I think, you know, as Michael was saying, you know, we're all three of us are writers, and, you know, that's literally the writing process. Is like, you will write about five sentences on a page and you'll be like, that's shit, and just delete it, and you'll be like, okay, let me start over, you know. And so that's how the process goes.
I mean, I've written two novels, I'm in the middle of a third and a fourth, and it's just like, yeah, sometimes you sit down and you write and you're like, well, now that I've got the bad stuff out of my system, and then you just delete all of it.
Sure.
And then there are times when you sit back and you're like, holy shit, I just said something profound. And I can guarantee that, for me anyway, the mix is about 872-1. Like, even the stuff that I keep is often like, that's good enough to get me on to the point where I will put down a better thing.
Sure.
Which is fine. It's a novel. Like, not every line's going to be the best thing you've ever written. But, yeah, I'll say that, like, this is one of the few movies that, like, treats writing. I've dabbled in poetry. It all sucks. It's like embarrassing how fucking bad my poetry is, because I've like tried formal rhyming poetry, and then I've tried free form, and I always have trouble with free form because it feels like I'm just writing a short story but just adding like line breaks at random points, and I can never tell what the hell's going on. But this movie is right up there with a 2007 movie called Starting Out in the Evening. Is anyone aware of that movie?
Nope.
No.
It stars Frank Langella as a a formerly great writer, and Lauren Ambrose is like a graduate student who goes and interviews him, and he, you know, makes a point of saying like, I carve out a period of time during the day where I sit down and write, and it doesn't matter if it's good or bad, but I've just got to be in front of the typewriter, everything pushed to the side, and just write. Like, it's important to do that, you know, because you have all these movies where like the person is just drinking and going out, and like they can't, they're like, I have writer's block, and they never seem to like sit down in front of a typewriter or a computer. And like, that's not quite writer's block, that is you just avoiding working. Like, you have to sit down and do it. And so seeing Patterson, the man, doing it every day, you know, to varying levels of success with varying levels of importance and everything, is interesting. And like, you know, he's not just sitting on a fucking bench waiting for the muse to hit him. Like, he's finding the muse in everything he does and making a point to put one down a day, which, I found refreshing and very realistic. But again, it's not a bad movie. It's just kind of like, it's just cool. It's like quaint and fine. And I don't know that there's much like to be made of it beyond that. Like, unless you do want to start questioning, like, are they trying to say something with like how successful his girlfriend is versus him?
See, that's so interesting that you say that his girlfriend is successful, because I don't think his girlfriend was successful.
Same.
At all.
She made $100 selling cupcakes.
She did. Sorry, Bill, go ahead.
Once. Yeah, that's literally what I'm saying. Like, she did it once, but she hasn't done it like on a continuous basis.
Well, this
so,
is the first time that the farmer's market's been back.
I understand, but you know, a success is not someone that sells $300 on a random weekend. A success is someone that sells $300 on every weekend for an entire year. Well, there you go. That's not enough.
When the sequel to this comes out before Style 10 years from now, see if she's become a cupcake person. I mean, I'm just saying, like, you know, like there's that fear of first failure that keeps so many people from trying so many things.
Sure.
Like, you know,
like I was mentioning earlier, she picks things up very quickly, it seems. Yeah. And she's got kind of this natural talent and this natural ability. And look, we all know those assholes out there that are just like, oh yeah, I dabbled in that and I was pretty good. And you know, you see their medals and shit like that, and you're just like, what do you mean you were good? Like, you won medals. Like, you weren't good, you were really good. So, you know, it's one of those things where I think, but it's funny because her particular thing is that she just won't settle on anything. Mm-hmm. And if she would actually put her mind to it and just like sit down and actually do it and follow through and be consistent with it, you know, she would actually have a lot of something, you know, and they wouldn't be struggling. They wouldn't be struggling to pay bills and shit like that. It would just be like, okay, here we go. But she's such a, I think the other part of it is, I think her flaw is that she is so able to pick so many things up that she can't decide what she wants to do because she's good at everything. And she's like, well, shit, like I didn't fail at that. I didn't fail at this. I didn't fail at that. Should I do all of those things? And it's like, no, you don't have enough time in the day.
Well, does she? She doesn't do anything else.
I don't know. I don't know if she leaves the house. That was what I was wondering the whole film. Yeah, I was just like, I don't know. Is she never going to leave this house?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's not. I mean, going off what Bill's saying, like speaking to specific like textual examples in the film, like it's not coincidental that like her, you know, that there's a point where she's first talking about this Esteban guitar, and Patterson is like, wait, what is this about? And she's like, oh, my dream to be a country star. And he's like, I thought your dream was to be a baker. As if like this is literally something that could have happened every week of their life together. Like there is something, there is something that I feel goes beyond like her picking up things really quickly. Like maybe she can do that, but I didn't even like get that as much as you guys did. Like I didn't get the sense that she was successful at either of those things. I'm sorry, learning three chords in the course of a day is not that much.
Well,
it's
tell
it's
that
really
to
not.
Me as a 14-year-old, I'm just saying, like, you know, the movie takes place over the course of a week. You know, so like our insight into their lives is limited.
But, sure,
like. It just feels like the movie is saying that. Like, I kept expecting, like, she's going to get this guitar, he's going to come home, it's going to, like, still be in the wrapper, and she's going to be, like, learning cactus horticulture or something like that. But instead, he comes home, and she's like, check this shit out, I can already do this. And it was, like, a little bit of a surprise. And then she goes and she does the cupcake thing, and again, is super successful. In my eyes, selling your entire stock and making that much money the first time you go out to a new farmer's market with cupcakes, I think that's impressive. I don't know about you people, but that's impressive to me.
I think that was just them trying to show her, trying to create her as a more well-rounded human being in the sense that she has successes, things like the guitar, things like the cupcakes, but she also has failures considering she couldn't make that quiche. Or was it a quiche?
I
can't remember what it was.
I think they were just trying to – I think they were just trying to show that she's real and that she actually leaves the house.
I think it's like a mixture. I think it's like – you kind of get built up for the fact that she's like spreading herself too thin, but then you see that she's actually like achieving a limited realistic level of success with everything that she does. And it's like, it's almost becomes like if this woman who is like scattershot and kind of a, you know, jack of all trades can do this, why doesn't Patterson put himself out? Like he's not steeped in failure. He has a very strangely successful girlfriend, but he doesn't seem to go for it. And then, you know, at the end of the movie...
It never rubs off on, on him.
And then
I feel like it's...
I'm sorry.
I feel like it's just meant as I don't know. I think trying to comb through this arc, it's not really going to be as satisfying as you want it to be. And I think on a script level, it really is just trying to contrast two different creative processes. Like, I don't think it's necessarily trying to say anything about success or failure, and maybe I'm totally wrong, but I think that is mostly meant as just a way to show how two different people follow their muses in very different ways and how those two coincide as people.
Yeah. So do we want to, I guess, do we want to, like, give...
Spoil the only thing.
Yeah, the only thing that happens. So spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen Patterson. I mean, the spoiler section is only going to be, like, 10 minutes long. We've already talked the themes and concepts of this movie to death. They go out after her cupcake success. I said it. And when they come back, the dog has destroyed his book of poems. And he seems... he's not, like, decimated. You know, he's not, like...
Sure.
Actually, have you ever seen the movie Wonder Boys?
Yes.
Okay, like, Michael Douglas in that movie, when he loses his, like, 2,000-page manuscript, is, like, shattered and, like, won't stop talking about how it's irreplaceable and everything. And Patterson,
sure,
like, is a little more blasé about it. He's a little more, like, rolling with the punch. And then, he's sitting by the waterfall, and he meets a Japanese businessman who is coming to Patterson specifically because of William Carlos Williams. And they talk a bit, and then the Japanese guy gives him a notebook. And then he leaves, and then Patterson begins writing a new poem.
Yeah, It's an interesting, there's some interesting things to unpack here, I have to say. I don't think it's totally satisfying.
Yeah.
And I did have this, actually, this conversation with my girlfriend when we were watching it, like, about whether him getting a notebook is in line with the rest of the movie. And I feel like it is. This whole movie is just kind of this very gentle form of surrealism, you know, not unlike something like, Carlos Williams. I was about to make the same mistake as Laura in the movie. So, but, like, there is just a certain, like, magical realism that does make sense. With that scene, but there is, I guess I can understand why that as an ending does feel a little bit, you know, pathetic. Like, it's kind of an anti-climax, which is weird to say for a movie that doesn't really have, like, you know, it's not a crescendo or anything, but it is, it doesn't really... It kind of starts over, and I guess if you have an interpretation that now he's really writing the real poems that matter to him, like, I do honestly find the poem he writes at the end the most interesting of anything he writes in the film, other than that little girl's poem. So I mean, but that, I guess that's a question then of whether you also feel that way. Did you feel that the poems earlier in the film are something that we're supposed to think is, you know, not genius, but something good? I don't know.
Particularly like any of them, but, like, I'm not
sure.
You know, my favorite poets are, like, here's a funny thing. I really can't think of any of their names right now.
Does T.S. Eliot count?
I hate T.S. Eliot with a passion. I like William Butler Yeats. I could try to look some up real quick, but I like William Butler Yeats. I like Gwendolyn Brooks. She's great. And then, Philip Larkin is another one. But, like, I'm not great with those, like, with poetry.
Sure.
Like, I can't read a poem and know if it's good or not. It's very subjective, but, like, I can't. So that's why I have trouble with it, you know, because I don't know if I'm supposed to think Patterson's poems are good. But, you know, it almost doesn't matter if they're good, because he's just out there and he's making it work for himself.
But that ending kind of changes depending on how you actually feel, I think, about the rest of his body of work, I guess.
Yeah, but, like, that's what's hard for me, is I just don't know what to think about it.
Where did you land on it, Bill?
On what?
Did
the
you
quality of his work?
Did you have any strong feelings about that?
Of Patterson's work?
Yeah.
Oh. No, I mean, it was okay. It was, like I said, poetry is not really my shit. So
sure.
especially not free form. Free form has its own rhythms and has its own kind of flow to it that, sure. It more has to do with the subject matter. And honestly, like, I'm like Brian. I've dabbled in poetry and I've written, mm-hmm. and there is nothing more that you can do to make yourself feel pretentious than writing poetry. It is devastating how much it just like makes you feel like the most awkward person you've ever been.
It is
a nightmare. Yeah, it is a nightmare to write.
The only thing worse than someone writing prose at a Starbucks is someone writing poetry at a Starbucks.
Yeah. But I mean, just reading like the intention behind the words and you're just like, oh God, I wrote that. And it's just like, oh Jesus. But like watching, so my big thing is there's two kinds of ways to kind of consume poetry, right? There's either reading it or there's listening to someone say it out loud. And I think Jarmusch is smart enough to realize, holy shit, if I had someone else say this or just put it up on the screen, it wouldn't quite have the impact of having Adam Driver actually read this out loud.
To that point, Bill, I think one of the smartest things this movie does is it never has him performing it. It has him saying it the way that you would say something to yourself when you're writing it down.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So it's halting and it like takes a while between words. And yeah, I think that's a clever, smart, guarded artistic conceit that the movie does.
Yeah, because it's almost like he's telling it to you in a stream of consciousness and he's not just reading it off of a page. So I think the way it's delivered is refreshing and nice instead of it just being, because I mean he literally writes about a fucking matchstick and you're just like, oh my God, what?
What is up with Jarmusch and matchsticks? Does anyone else like
matchstick?
Matches were like a huge part of Limits of Control. And then in this movie, like one of the first scenes, he picks up a matchbook. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, again?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's so weird. Filmmakers are so weird because I had the opportunity to talk to Tim Burton briefly. And I asked him about his kind of obsession with black and white. And he had a very kind of nonchalant answer, and he was just like, I don't know. I like that color scheme. And I was just like, you got to be fucking kidding me. Like, black and white is a thing throughout your entire film career, and you're telling me that you've never really like sat down and thought about like why black and white is a big thing in your film career.
It'd be better if he had never even noticed it.
Yeah, it's the authorial
voice.
No, I mean intention is often different than what they actually intended. It can be read into and things like that, and so there's always this question of what they knew. I've listened to so many different interviews with like Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men. And like when he has someone that's a very smart interviewer that is picking up on things, he will very noticeably just be like, I didn't even put those two things together. Like, you know, I have an overarching theme for the season, but I don't try and like connect little dots all throughout and pay attention to it, to the minutia. And, you know, smart people are like, whoa, look at this shit. Like, you didn't realize that? And he's like, no, sorry. I don't worry about it in that micro way. And so, you know, I don't know if even Jarmusch maybe even realizes that theme is kind of playing out in his own films. He very much may just be like, whoa, shit, that is something, you know.
That reminds me of like when Lynch is asked about, you know, his pet themes, and it's just like, oh, you saw that? Interesting. like it's just, it's something so subconscious at a certain point.
Yeah.
That exactly what you're saying, Bill. Like, yeah, I guess that makes a lot of sense.
Oh.
Yeah. That's about it.
I guess the one other thing I'd say
it's the delightful film, and I love that they
said
apparently
it's a good way to waste 2 hours.
Yeah, it is. Like I can't fault you for sitting down and watching this. Like, and you'd probably be like, well, that was worth it, but is it something that I would ever like watch again? No, not necessarily. My stupid thing, for me is I love that they trained a dog to fucking knock over a mailbox. Like, that's delightful. And I love that little thing actually has like kind of – he never finds out, but we sure find out. And it's like, thank you. Like that's delightful that he just fucking threw that in there for us. He literally threw us a bone.
I mean, you know, he didn't toss a bone at us, but yeah.
Yeah, it is weird because, like, that is – a lot of these things that you're picking up, Bill, are almost things that are in Jarmusch movies. But I imagine, given your interests in – I doubt you would find some of, like, his material to be satisfying, because it's kind of weird, Brian, that you said – this almost feels pointless or like, you know, whatever, because that's a little bit Jarmusch's MO at times. Like, his movies are often like detours to nowhere.
Right, and that's like, what made this one seem so – that's why it was so weird that this one –
because it's the main road.
Yeah. It's, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I like The Limits of Control. That movie is 40 minutes of nothing. And then, like, 4 lines of dialogue, and then another 40 minutes of nothing. And that just keeps happening. Like, if I like that, I should like anything.
To that movie.
I don't know. And then, like I said, like, you know, Jean Dielman, again, this is like a less pointed Jean Dielman, but similar enough in its own way. And I didn't really like Jean Dielman until the last, like, 15 minutes. You know, it's one of those things where, like, you can't judge a movie until you've seen the whole thing. And then
sure
you get what it's doing. But, like, this one at the end, it's kind of like, was that it? Was that, like, what I was waiting for? You know, is that the story? It's, like, a cute, fine story, but it's like if I was friends with Patterson, like, you know, if we ran into each other on a bus and, like, had to have a chat, and then I got off the bus, would I ever be like, you know, I should try to, like, look that guy up? No. But the bus trip is over now, and it passed a little quicker because Patterson was there.
Yeah, you know, I'm happy he's making movies. He can keep making movies, even if they, you know, want to be, you know, things that feel a little more nothing, or feel like, you know, a way to showcase a place and some great character actors. Which, by the way, this is just has some, you know, Barry Shabaka Henley as the bartender is just, you know, he's a real amiable, but not like, you know, overly nice or, you know, like stereotypical bartender. You have like, you know, Method Man in one single scene, or William Jackson Harper from The Good Place is like this temperamental, you know, romantic. And, you know, like it's all these little things that he does that does make this feel like so much more than just a, you know, a rote character study.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, that is it for today. We will be back this weekend to talk about Wonder Woman. So y'all can look forward to that. In the meantime, MUBI is offering a 30-day free trial to anyone who goes to MUBI.com/filmstage. Again, MUBI has a wonderful app on your phone and on Roku and online where you can get access to their 30-film-strong library of rotating content. Every day they introduce a new film, and you have 30 days to watch before it disappears into the ether. You can also download these things to your mobile device so that you can watch them on the go. So if you would like your free 30-day trial of MUBI on us, go to MUBI.com/filmstage. All right, we've already told the people what we're going to be talking about next time, so there's nothing left to do but tell them what we can find between now and then. Bill Graham.
You can find me trying to adopt Marvin on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me... Oh, Marvin is the dog, by the way. And
I was like,
you
who
can,
the fuck is Marvin?
Yeah, sorry. And you can find me writing about movies on the film stage and freshfiction.tv.
All right, Michael Snidell.
You can find me writing poetry that I'm never going to let anybody ever read on Twitter at Snidell. And you can see my thoughts on things I'm watching. I did a marathon of the High School Musical series in the past couple days. Someone put up some thoughts on Letterboxd at the, which is Snidell. So just check that out.
All right. You can find me continuing not to really get quote-unquote poetry on Twitter, at Brian J. Rowan. You can find me on Letterboxd that way as well. And you can find me writing about stuff at thefilmstage.com and my personal site, dearfilm.net. And that's all. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Hope you enjoyed us actually talking about Patterson this time. And remember that we will be talking about Wonder Woman come the weekend. So get out and go see that if you'd like, so you can be up to date for the conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much, and tune in next time. It's not much, but it's the best I can do. My gift is my song, and this one's for you. And you can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but